The Guardian.
Hello and welcome back to the roller coaster romance that is The Guardian Film Show. And apologies for our absence last week. Events intervened and they split us up. But now we're back, a little older, a little bit more embittered, but still hoping to rekindle old passions. We'll see how that one turns out as the show unfolds. Flowering like blossom on this week's broadcast. The lads light out for Spike Island in Matt Whitecross's swaggering salute to 1990 and all that. Brad Pitt takes on the undead in World War Z. And Abbas Kiarostami goes in search of closure in the Tokyo set like someone in love. But we start with a love story for our age, a soap opera for advancing years. It's time for our now traditional 9-year visit to the star-crossed lovers Celine and Jesse. First, there was Before Sunrise, then came Before Sunset. Now, they are in their 40s, strolling the footpaths of Greece, still in search of a happy ending.
So he and Melina were a real thing.
Yeah.
What's going to happen now?
I don't know. They must be friends. Facebook, you know, they'll keep in touch at least for a while.
Hey, what if they end up spending their whole life together, you know?
You're so corny. Sometimes no, I'm just like, I mean, what are you, a 12-year-old girl? First love? Do you even remember who it was?
Yeah, I do. It was you.
Oh, please, like you're a virgin at 23.
No, you said first love, not first sexual experience, okay?
Okay, fine.
The course of true love bumps and rattles through the Peloponnese on Before Midnight, Richard Linklater's third film about Celine and Jesse, who met in Vienna and then re-met in Paris. Julie Delpy and Ethan Hawke are in loquacious mood, wending their way from airport to dinner table, to chapel to harbour. But the emotional storm clouds appear to be massing.
You're so working on our little night.
Hell yeah. I got a Trojan in my billfold and a racket in my pocket.
I'm stuck with an American teenager.
I'm joined now by the Guardian film critic Peter Bradshaw and films editor Catherine Shord. Catherine, was it nice to see Celine and Jesse? It's been a long time, hasn't it?
It was heavenly. I mean, it's one of those things that before you're sort of worried about it because, everyone who loves these films feels very invested in them and they're so perfect and you don't really even want to revisit them, let alone sort of see another thing that might disappoint. But in fact, it's just as good. It's absolutely wonderful. It's a perfect film and it takes your breath away because it moves you just the same. It's incredibly engaging. Technically, it's astonishing. Mm. It's amazing not only to have these long, unbroken takes of sort of 10 minutes or whatever, but it doesn't ever feel stagey because it's not theatre. They're walking around. It's sort of easy to overlook the amazing logistical feat that this film is. For me, it was wonderful. The only thing was the ending didn't quite have the beautiful snap of the ending of Before Sunrise.
Oh, yeah, but that's one of the great endings of the last 20 years, isn't it?
Yeah, it set the bar high, but you expect them to pole vault it. But apart from that, it was pretty much perfect.
Peter, how is this one different? I mean, they're getting older, and that's defining the character of these films, isn't it?
Yes, to some extent. I think this is different in a sense that there's less for them to be curious about. They haven't lost their idealism, and they haven't lost their curiosity about the world. They've lost a little curiosity about the future, other than in the anxious sense of what is the future going to hold with regard to our relationship with our children. That is the new thing. The relationship with your children is very, very new. And I thought very movingly handled, actually, very subtly handled. There's something almost miraculous about these movies. The emphasis that they place on conversation and talking, simply not doing anything else, just talking, and making that absolutely gripping. I love it. I think it has a lightness without being lightweight. And it's accessible and intimate and very intelligent. And it sort of enfolds you in its romantic grasp.
I love how, I mean, they're very self-absorbed and they're talking about big things, but it nicely undercuts it. There's a bit where they're walking along the footpath and he's saying, I'm glad I got off that train and spoke to you 18 years ago. It's the best thing I ever did. And she goes, oh, look at the goats.
Yeah.
And there's this sort of wonderful thing that real life keeps kind of intruding on this idyll and this reverie.
Yeah, its relationship with its own mythology is absolutely fascinating, isn't it? I mean, the way in which you've got these two books that he's written. I mean, it's like the Back to the Future trilogy, or it's potentially even better, which is not words I thought I'd ever hear myself say. Because the levels of sort of reflection and interaction, and it's so beautifully constructed. It's absolutely magnificent like that.
I think if we're following this couple and we're invested in this couple, there will be people that are disappointed that all is not entirely rosy in their lives.
Well, I think they might think, as I thought if I was casting about for kind of flaws in it, I thought perhaps it is a little cliche that he's a successful writer and she's a less successful environmentalist. It might have been more interesting to have his career sort of hit the buffers and have her career as an environmentalist suddenly take off. That would be very interesting. The traditional thing in any compromise, in any relationship, is whose career has to suffer. Jesse's career doesn't have to suffer. He can live in Paris. Now he's talking about, should they move back to the US? And that has triggered a very interesting latent rage in Céline. And I found that very interesting. Her dormant sense of resentment at him and his Americanness was starting to come out. Beautifully handled, though.
Catherine, do you think this is it? I mean, each time we think, oh, maybe that's the end of the story, and then 9 years, there's another one, and it's this kind of wonderful chance encounter again. Do you think that this is the right place to stop, or do you want them to carry on having these nine-year intervals with a new film?
I want them to carry on. It gives you something to live for, doesn't it? But also,
it does. That's sad, but
I know.
It's true.
Yeah,
it's
tragic.
It really does. But also, you know, I thought the second one, it couldn't have ended in a more perfect way. And yet, for me, this third one made it richer, made it more interesting. I hope they will do it every 9 years. I mean, I would say the one thing is that this dormant rage of Céline's, I'm not 100% comfortable with the... with who you're meant to sympathise with in this relationship at this stage, because she is pretty screechy and mad, and you're definitely on his side for the good last third of it, and he is definitely portrayed as the more sympathetic one.
And he gets the best lines in terms of coming back at her.
He does, and I did feel a bit uneasy about that in some sort of strange Femi way, but maybe, you know, I haven't revisited the earlier works because I can't bear to, in case they're not as good as I remember.
I think in the first two, she's definitely the more powerful one. He's the kind of weak little kid.
He's the suitor.
And she's the sort of sophisticated European.
I see. But is she still a little bit nuts and screechy?
A little bit, but
women.
It's getting worse. That's what happens.
Yes.
If I could change one thing about you, it would be for you to stop trying to change me.
You are a very skilled manipulator.
Well, I'm on to you. I know how you work.
You think?
Yeah, I know everything about you. Here we go. Let's go through here.
I don't think you do, actually.
No? Well, I know you better than I know anybody else on the planet, but maybe that's not saying much.
What? This is great.
Right?
You know, I feel close to you.
Yeah.
But sometimes, I don't know, I feel like you're breathing helium and I'm breathing oxygen.
What makes you say that?
Julie Delpy and Ethan Hawke in those quiet moments before midnight, just before they are set upon by a pack of ravening zombies. Sorry, that's not right. I'm confusing the first film with the second. This is World War Z.
Connie, there's a helicopter waiting for us on the roof. Keep your eyes on Mommy and Daddy, okay?
How do we know they're coming?
They're coming.
First, the bad news. Our planet has been hit by a zombie pandemic. Then, the good news. Brad Pitt's intrepid UN investigator is on the case and hunting a cure. The bad news, time is running out. The good news, Brad Pitt. This, in summary, is World War Z. Peter, did Brad Pitt convince you that he can save the world?
No, I don't think he could save himself. I certainly can't save this movie. I don't know what's gone wrong with this movie. Something has gone very wrong, though. It has become legendary and notorious for its agonising production history, rewrites and rehirings, the original and quite complex satirical novel being junked entirely in favour of a much more trad action thriller disaster movie, much more trad. The ending apparently junked and then junked and then junked again until finally we show up in this lab just outside Cardiff in the valleys, you know, or well, not in the valleys, but
when all else fails, Cardiff,
exactly. Exactly. And we turn up and Brad has to confront, I don't want to give it away, some zombies in this setting with Peter Capaldi shows up and he has to say things like, oh my God, he's going to do this, and oh my God, he's going to do that. I don't know what's gone wrong. It starts off very well, actually. The scene in Philadelphia at the very beginning, there's something very weird about that. Before you, they're in the car and they're in a traffic jam and then there's something's happened, they don't know what, and then they can see some form of urban disorder up ahead and you don't know what it is. And it's quite interesting. Yeah. It's quite interesting because you don't know what these people are. But then you find out what they are. They're zombies. Now, there is a debate to be had. How scary and interesting are zombies? I've never been entirely convinced. I thought Edgar Wright got it right with Shaun of the Dead when he played up the comedy aspect of them and the overtly satirical aspect of them. Because I've never really took them seriously as scary things.
They're satirical vessels, aren't they? Yes. Even when they're scary, like in Night of the Living Dead. There's a definite invitation to kind of think, this is us.
There is a long-standing established tradition to read zombieism as satire, and I get that. What I don't get is the idea that they are quite exciting and interesting and wow. I don't get that in a way that I sort of get it with, I don't know, werewolves and vampires and all the rest of it. I get that. But there's something about zombies I sort of tune out a bit, really. There are some interesting things. I mean, Danny Boyle did zombies really well. He invented the idea of the zombie that can run, for example, which tipped the evolutionary balance of survival in the zombies. Yes,
forget the Olympics opening ceremony. Yes. Invented zombies.
The running
that can
zombie,
run.
Yes. Well, it tipped the evolutionary balance in the zombies' favour, very, very famously. And this film is indebted to Mr. Boyle, as indeed we all are. It really was very boring after a while. Mm. It really didn't know where it was going and it was pretty dull.
Hold, clear.
One ammo count, then you reload your match.
Yes, sir.
The noise. Are they drawn to it?
Yeah. Sam draws them.
You fought any yet?
Philly, Newark.
Good.
What about Houston, Lewis?
Baltimore. Atlanta.
Detroit?
Guys, I'll be honest with you. I don't know of any place back home that's doing very well.
That's the Hollywood blockbuster World War Z shuffling towards Cardiff to die. In the meantime, we're cutting it loose. We're parting company and we're heading over to Tokyo, the setting for the new film from the great Iranian director Abbas Kiarostami. Abbas Kiarostami is a stranger in a strange land, forced out of his native habitat to alight in Japan. Like Someone in Love is his teasing tale of the games we play and the roles we adopt, spotlighting the relationship between a student turned escort and an elderly professor who books her for the night. Catherine, this film played in Cannes, I think, last year, and really annoyed people. Were you weren't one of those people then?
No, it slipped down a treat for me. And actually, although I saw it a long time ago, probably a bit drunk, I remember it really well. It has a strange quality, doesn't it? It's a very... it reminded me more and more of The Apartment, because it's quite funny, and it involves a bloke, helping a lady who's a bit troubled in an apartment. And also of Drive, that I've seen in cars. sort of basic comparisons. But it has a very Kiarostami quality all of its own. I loved it actually. I really, there's something very charming about it and very sort of, there's a slight edge of sinister all the way through. Not really an edge, a massive great side of sinister, which I quite liked.
The problem was, for people, that the ending seems to have gone AWOL.
Yeah, as I say, I'm very perplexed by this movie. I'm perplexed by the movie itself. I'm slightly perplexed by the extravagant and saucer-eyed way in which it has been received, although I absolutely appreciate Catherine's view. It is brilliantly made. It is made with absolutely deliberate poise. Yeah. It's very well acted. And I put my hand on my heart, and I bow to no one in my admiration for the great man. But I can't help thinking that he's given us three quarters of a very, very good, very conventional movie, and the ending he has withheld or abolished or, dare I say it, failed to think of.
Do you think that? I think it's entirely intentional,
oh, yes,
this ending.
I think it is. I get that. it reminds me a little bit of the anti-ending, famously, of A Taste of Cherry, which kind of challenged your narrative expectations. But I think that did it much better. Yeah. This, I think it's just not there. Mm. It's just a sort of missing reel effect. You just look, wait, hang on. Because, you know, nothing's, it's not building up to anything. It's unfinishedness doesn't appear to resonate in any way. I found myself standing on my head trying to find ways in which it did.
Mm. Do you think that his exile, basically, from Iran, in terms of making movies, has hobbled him, or is he making kind of lemonade out of lemons? Because these films are, this and Certified Copy, the one that preceded it, which was set in Tuscany, they're very much about feeling a bit out of place, taking on a costume, seeing if that fits. And I find that kind of interesting. He's making a kind of bonus of being a bit of a square peg.
Yeah, I mean, Certified Copy, if you compare it to something like Before Midnight, which it sort of heavily resembles, really, it doesn't look so great. And I found that ultimately unsatisfying. And I found the sort of conventional ending of Certified Copy, or conventional in inverted commas, much more unsatisfying than the ending of this. This didn't bother me at all, in the same way that The Serious Man didn't bother me at all. And I took the meaning of both those to be fairly similar, which is ultimately, you know, they're a bit screwed, and that's not going to go well. And you can imagine, you don't need to see. You can,
the third act is going to be the same.
Yeah. So, you could have just had that.
The very last scene from Like Someone in Love There. As for us, we're ending in the past. We're turning back the clock to that heady day in 1990 where we all decided to sack off work, pack up our picnic hamper and bicycle off to Spike Island to enjoy a little contemporary music. And as it happened, the day turned out a bit like this.
And then we heard it. The roar of cheers that told us the Roses had walked on stage and the rumble of Manny's bass. The greatest party in the history of the world. We were invited.
Director Matt Whitecross resurrects the spirit of May 1990, just before the World Cup and the invasion of Kuwait, when the Stone Roses played Spike Island outside of Widnes. For those who went, it was the UK's answer to Woodstock, with added smokestacks, chemicals, and fishing hats.
Peter, what were you doing in May 1990?
I think I was doing something like that. I think I was in the office. The awful thing is I'd love to pretend that I was, you know, anywhere near Spike Island, but I wasn't. I enjoyed this. I thought it was like a B-side to Shane Meadows' documentary about the Stone Roses. I think it got quite a lot of the atmosphere, quite a lot of the period. I'm very interested now in the 90s. It's interesting to have the 90s enjoying a slight resurgence, I think, a kind of pre-Blair 90s, in the golden age of John Major and Virginia Bottomley, you know, that 90s. I found it summoned up quite a lot of the, I hesitate to say the energy because I'm totally unqualified to talk about the energy, but I think what it had was something of the sentimental euphoria of that kind of music, that kind of guitar band music, which I found utterly distinctive. That sort of, I don't know, tear-jerking music, very emotional, but very, very of its time. And I think
working class yearning.
Yes, a real yearning, but not sad either. Kind of happy in a weird way. And I thought Matt Whitecross did a good job in summoning it up. I'm not quite sure how new this is really, but I thought the acting was very good. As I say, as a way of pastiching the past, I think he did a pretty good job.
It's full of cliche, though, isn't it?
Oh, it's massive. Oh, the whole thing. It's one massive, baggy, kind of Manc cliche. It's fantastic. Although I did like the idea when they were in Widnes that they were suddenly, they weren't in Manchester anymore. Yeah. They weren't in Kansas anymore. They were in Merseyside. And suddenly they are, you know, this isn't considering this is their, these are their people, they find themselves in a foreign country. They found themselves with Scousers. They can't make out what they're saying. The people on the gate are real Scousers and they hate Man U and they hate everybody. And I quite like that. I thought that was very funny.
Catherine, you wanted to go to the Stone Roses concert the other week, didn't you?
But well, I did, but luckily me and Peter live very close to it. Yes. So all we needed to do was open our open our doors. I went onto a railway bridge, and I expect one day somebody will make a film
about yes, us. That.
But did you go then? Because you were at college in Manchester.
I was, yeah. I was too busy studying.
Yeah.
To be a doctor.
What's happening?
The wind's changed direction.
Fuck me!
Get on that!
We're out of Spike Island and clean out of time. Just one last order of business before we go. Today is Peter's birthday, and we're not about to let that pass without party hats, cake,
and the national anthem.
And the national anthem. Happy birthday, Peter.
Oh, thank you. I don't know what to say. Thank you, chaps. You shouldn't have.
We shall now draw the curtain on this wild revelry. The spirit of Spike Island lives on, kind of. See you next week.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.